Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
We'll be back tomorrow. We've got a busy schedule for you today. My guests are Sue Minter, Executive Director for Capstone Community Action, Ben Kinsley, who's a member of the Board of Directors along with me on Campaign for Vermont, Gary Freimeyer, who's the President of the USS Vermont Submarine Support Group, and to top it off, Mary Moulton, who's the CEO of the Washington County Mental Health. If you want to talk to any of these guests, the number to call in here at WDEV is 244-1777. And I'd like to welcome Sue Minter, if you're on the line, Sue.
Good morning, Pat. Thank you so much for inviting us to join you, and I'm so glad you are here on WDEV Live and Local.
Thank you, and thanks for the plug. That's a good one. I haven't seen you in a little while. Sue, I'm a host for Vote for Vermont, and Sue has been on my show more than once. What we'd like to do, Sue, is to start with an overview of Capstone, which is one of Vermont's CAP agencies. Maybe you can talk a little bit about Capstone.
Sure. Thank you so much. Yeah, Capstone Community Action is one of five community action agencies, CAPs, here in Vermont, really helping to meet individuals and families who may be facing hardship and to help them rise out of poverty. Capstone, here in central Vermont, serves the counties of Washington, Lamoille, and Orange. And then there are different CAP agencies all around the state. And really we're all independent, nonprofit organizations with our own boards of directors from the communities we serve. But we all have an overriding mission of really helping, people out of poverty. And, you know, I will say right now our challenges have been intensifying since the pandemic, both in terms of the health and economic challenges that people are finding.
Yeah, it must be very difficult. I know when you were on the show, I was so impressed with what you've been doing in response to COVID. And maybe you could talk a little bit about the impact of COVID on your clients and what you're doing, because I know you're working, you know, just about 24/7 on this issue.
It has really been like that. It's been an emergency response for us and many, many others. You know, probably what's important to realize about our work is we have a two-pronged approach. We really try to help people who are in crisis. We help make sure they make ends meet. And then we give them the tools to rise out of poverty. But right now, a significant amount of our work is on crisis response, particularly around food security and housing security. We worked with other partners in Washington County in particular and Lamoille County to help ensure that the unhoused or homeless neighbors, as the pandemic hit, were actually safely housed. And the state stepped up and was willing to house people in the area motels. Well, a whole network of providers with Capstone have been trying to make sure those guests of the hotels are safe, that they get food, that they get medical support and COVID testing, get fed. There's a whole lot of work involved with that. We also try to work with landlords to invest in some of the housing that, you know, landlords may have units that needed to be upgraded. And there was pandemic COVID relief dollars that flowed through the state to help those landlords invest in their units to bring them up to code and then hopefully house safely some folks that we support to get out of homelessness or into more safe housing. So we've been working with our partners at Downstreet Housing to build more units and get people more safely housed for the long run. And then, you know, we also run the Head Start program here in this county and all three counties, actually. And, you know, that really is critical work with children many at-risk families who really are facing multiple barriers, and we provide child care centers and also home visitors for those who really can't manage to bring their children to child care. And we see the needs not just for early childhood development and education, but also for supporting families to get out of poverty. We have a range of programs we could talk about with that really help empower people financially, coaching them with about credit and asset building. We have a workforce development program called the Community Kitchen Academy and a micro business development program. So a range of programs, many and all of which really have been almost on steroids to address the increasing needs of our community that we serve due to this pandemic.
You know, you kept mentioning the word safe. And I think that from what I've heard from the homeless here in this area, that that word's just being safe for families and for the homeless is really key. They just want to be safe. And I think that's really an important message.
You know, it's so right. You're so right, Pat. And it does point to something that we really start to realize with the pandemic is we're all only as safe in the end as our neighbor. Mm-hmm. So when we all needed to stay home and stay safe to ensure the virus, to reduce the spread as we did in the beginning, if you don't have a home, you can't be
right,
safe.
Right.
And so, and nor can your neighbors. So, you know, the state really wisely stepped up to the plate to make sure people did have a place to go. And now we want them to be safe where they are. And most importantly, our objective is to create more housing so that they can have long-term
right.
safety and stability.
Exactly. I guess I don't think any of us really think about safe. But when you and I were talking, I was thinking about myself and my family, and it's just maybe something we take for granted, but other people can't. Can you talk a little bit? You mentioned the Community Kitchen Academy, which is just one of my all-time favorite programs that you do, and also talk about what the state has done with restaurants to provide food, if you could.
Absolutely. So our Community Kitchen Academy, understandably, is a favorite. It's a partnership with the Vermont Food Bank. And at our food shelf in Barrie at Gable Place, which is the largest food shelf in the central Vermont area, we also have an industrial kitchen. And in that kitchen, we provide a workforce development program for folks who are unemployed to become proficient in the kitchen and in the restaurant industry. And it is an amazing program because it not only gives people skills, it gives them credentials. We also help them with their resume building, interview skills. We give them financial counseling and, most importantly, skills and credentials
right.
for the kitchen. But we place them into jobs generally at the end. And before COVID, we had a 96% success rate at placing people in restaurants. But to your point, the world is very different now.
Yep.
We continue to have our program, our Community Kitchen Academy, and every day we are producing healthy, nutritious meals that then go out to food insecure families. Well, what you were also referring to with post the pandemic, and I do want to just credit, we repurposed our Community Kitchen Academy into a mass feeding program for those homeless guests in the hotels, because at the beginning there was no system to help them get their meals. We created an instant utilizing those students and our kitchen to make healthy meals, and then hundreds of volunteers were delivering those meals, and this went on for months. In the end, the volunteers delivered over 81,000
wow.
meals.
That's amazing.
And by the way, there's over 300 people in these hotels, 7 different hotels in the area. But anyway, this also became an idea that has spread across the state, and we now are part of a statewide program called the Vermont Everyone Eats Program, and this is specifically a pandemic response program where the state, through the Federal CARES Act dollar, is actually paying restaurants to provide meals that we then distribute to the food insecure families that we know about. And when I say we, I'm talking about Capstone Community Action, in partnership with Skinny Pancake, has become what they call a regional food hub of this statewide program.
That's great.
So we kind of jumped in In big part because of our Community Kitchen Academy and our comfort with that work. And we are working with 39 different organizations throughout Washington, Lamoille, and Orange County to deliver meals to very rural areas from Wolcott to Rochester to Bradford and beyond. And so we are really using a tremendous delivery system to people who really need food more than ever.
I just can't think of a better win-win for the restaurants there. They're getting paid to provide food, so that'll help them keep in business because as we ride around our Washington County, I see one business sort of after another closing, and it's pretty sad. And I'm assuming that once this is over, you've got a very active, you've mentioned it already, the community economic development programs will be critical to help us get back on track.
You know, I want to tell you a terrific local story, because just to echo your point, please visit your local restaurants. This program, the Vermont Everyone Eats program, is a big help, but it's not solving the problem, and our restaurants need us. Great local story in Waterbury, the Blackback Pub did a fundraiser one night. They said they wanted to support Capstone's Fuel Your Neighbors campaign, and we put it out on, you know, Front Porch Forum and on email and social media, and the goal was that they would put tips toward our program, and it was by the owners of the wonderful Blackback Pub.
Great.
And that night, it was fantastic. They were packed full. They ran out of food for to-go menus. They had more activity than they'd have all season since the pandemic. They were so grateful, but incredibly, talk about a win-win, they also donated the tips to our Fuel Your Neighbors campaign, $800.
Oh, wow.
From one night. So that was a win-win, and I really just want to thank the Blackback Pub and all of the neighbors who supported them and supported us at Capstone. Our Fuel Your Neighbors campaign, by the way, we are in the middle of this campaign, which really, Pat, was kicked off through WDEV and has made such a tremendous difference. Let me tell you, we actually are close to exceeding our original goal. And it has to do not only with the tremendous outpouring of our neighbors and our supporters, but also some larger gifts from the Vermont Community Foundation, which has helped us, frankly, leapfrog forward. And just recently, we have a gift, a matching gift from the National Life Foundation of $7,500.
Wow.
And if we can match that gift, we will have reached our goal and close our campaign early. So I am mentioning to folks today, fuelyourneighbors.org, if you want to help finalize our campaign. Because what this does is it supports all of the food programs we were just discussing, from the community kitchen to the food shelf, and we're calling it a food shelf without walls now, because we really know many people can't get to us. So we're thinking about how do we change our model to get food to people who need it. But also heat. We haven't talked about the fact that it's winter, and many, many Vermonters do not have enough money to stay warm. This program, Fuel Your Neighbors, helps support those families in need. We say we try to make sure that no one goes to sleep hungry or cold. So that's something else I wanted to share
with
the listeners today.
Well, I need to give you a lot of kudos, you and your staff, because I've heard from other nonprofits what a great job you've done in organizing a lot of this stuff and just bringing everybody together. And don't you feel that citizens, people, Vermonters, are being more generous through COVID than perhaps they just know that people are in trouble and they're responding in kind because I just see it, and you can feel it when you're talking to people. So that's a good thing.
I literally feel chills when you're saying this, Pat, because we didn't think we would be able to raise the full $200,000 that we set for a goal, and we're surpassing that goal early, exactly to your point. People know there is tremendous suffering and challenge ahead. There's suffering now and challenge ahead, and that's what we're trying to be able to resource that generosity and get it right into the pockets and the households of the people who need it, whether it's for food, medicine, and most importantly right now in the winter, heat.
Yeah, maybe, Sue, you can take the few minutes that are left to talk about weatherization and the great Paul Zabriskie who is running that. I love Paul. He's great. He's run that program for quite a while.
Yes, and thank you for mentioning it, because it's you may have heard the governor is really proposing to expand weatherization, and what we do at the CAP agencies is low-income weatherization. So really, the state helps subsidize a program where we go into folks' homes and weatherize it, so make it more energy efficient. And what that does is so important, because we know that it can reduce the fuel, the heating costs, by half. So that they won't have to come for emergency fuel in the next year. But it also does tremendous other things, including make the household more healthy. We've found that there are studies about indoor air quality that significantly improves the health outcomes of those families. And, of course, we're all concerned, and actually the governor's proposal relates to climate change. It reduces the amount of energy we need to consume as a state. So this is a huge focus for the legislature and the governor to expand how do we actually reduce consumption of energy, and our weatherization program does that for folks with low income. So it's a tremendous program done all over the state, and here in the center of the state, the amazing Paul Zabriskie is the director of our program.
Well, I was over with Paul one day, can't remember what job I had at the time, but I was meeting with him, and the weatherization program, it's sometimes things very simple that's a fix that will last and make such an impact on your house. It's not major construction. It's just, fixes that just won't take that much effort or time. And Paul and his crew just know where to look and what to do. And, it just,
right. Crawl into attics and basements, and they put in insulation and they upgrade the furnaces, and those fixes can make life-changing improvements to the fuel bills and the indoor air quality.
Yeah, it's great, and I really appreciate the work that Paul does. I had mentioned before, and I don't think we focused on it, but when the pandemic is over, the economic development program that you've got going, particularly workforce development, which the legislature has been focusing on for the last couple of years. What do you see happening when the pandemic is over and these programs kick in and help us get back on our feet?
Thank you for asking that important question, because we've got to begin thinking now about what happens next. And so many people are being dislocated from their jobs, and we need to be thinking about the jobs of the future. Weatherization is a great example. If we're going to actually expand the amount that we do, we're going to need more people trained in this industry. Mm-hmm. We're going to have to be thinking about the industries of tomorrow and making sure, especially, that people go on beyond high school into whether it's technical ed, community college. We're going to need to think very strategically about how we train people so they can be successful for tomorrow. So we work with partners around the state on that. We also work with families about understanding their individual finances. You know, many people grow up without truly understanding budgeting and credit and asset building, and so we have a specific program to help. We call it money coaching. So we help people understand their budgets and how to save and how to actually establish credit. And the legislature has funded something called the Vermont Matched Savings Program. So when people put $1,000 in savings, it gets matched by the state. And that has to go towards either fixing their home, their car, or investing in post-secondary education. So we are helping those who really haven't had a vision for their future going beyond high school, or how to actually save for a car or for a home. And that is tremendously important work that we also do at Capstone Community Action through our economic development program.
That's great.
I want to mention, because it's tax season, Pat, we do help people with taxes. We have a volunteer income tax program.
Oh, that's great, because I'd be right there if I didn't have we use an accountant finally, but doing it myself was always a struggle. And that's good you help them.
Before we close, I want to make sure people know how to get help. If they need help finding secure housing, help with heat, food, or taxes, call 1-800-693-1053. That's 1-800-639-1053. I may have flipped the numbers there because, or you can call WDEV and they'll forward you to the right place.
Isn't this place great? WDEV. I love it. I think you've also said ask for help, and I've, been reading some articles, that people are encouraging others to ask for help. It's okay. This is a state that provides a lot of services that will help you, and particularly in the cold and with COVID, that if you need help, just raise your hand and you'll be okay. So, Sue, we have
and
two more minutes.
You're so right, Go ahead.
No, I'm just going to say we have two more minutes if you wanted to wrap up with things that we haven't talked about.
Well, I just want to really reinforce your point, because people, Vermonters, are so proud, and many, many people are, for the very first time in their lives, and through no fault of their own, since this pandemic, finding themselves in a real crisis.
Yep.
And people are very reticent to ask for help. The easiest place to go right away is 211. But we know in this, if your help is that you need is food, is financial support, is income tax support, is heat, or if you have a dream of starting your own business or want your house weatherized or need your child in child care, Capstone Community Action is there to provide those kinds of services. You can go to capstonevt.org or call 1-800-639-1053. And we really know that people are in a crisis in some cases, or are just seeing it around the horizon. We're here to help, and we really are so grateful for all the listeners who have helped us become a stable organization to be able to provide that kind of support.
The one statistic, we have to do a hard break in a sec, the one statistic that absolutely blows my mind is it's 1 in 3 people in Vermont deal with food insufficiency. And you can't tell by somebody's home or what they have if they're struggling behind those doors. So reach out, everybody, and if you need help, ask for it and contact Capstone. Sue Minter, it has been great to talk to you. Thanks for being willing to come on the show, and I hope people reach out.
Thank you, Pat, for being a part of the WDEV family.
Thank you. It's great. We'll see you.
Let's celebrate Valentine's Day at the Warren Store with a very special meal created by our culinary experts. Check out warrenstore.com for details. We have a great assortment of cards and gifts and chocolate-dipped strawberries. Upstairs, we have puzzles, journals, art supplies, and candles to warm and while away the winter days. Dress yourself in cozy tops, snuggly sweaters, and happy colors. You can now order online from the deli at warrenstore.com. Warren Village is a winter wonderland, so come to soothe your soul, fill your tummy, and dress your body. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, open 7:30 to 5.
Well, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. This is Pat McDonald, your guest host. Rick Sangare will be back tomorrow. If you want to speak to any of our guests today, you can call in 244-1777. And joining me right now is Ben Kinsley. Ben, are you there?
Hi, I'm there. Hey, Pat.
Hey, long time no see. Ben and I are on the board of directors of Campaign for Vermont, and I just wanted Ben to talk a little bit about Campaign for Vermont before we get into the nitty-gritty of this interview.
Sure, yeah. And, you know, Campaign for Vermont, I've worked with the organization for a number of years. And what we try to do is look at issues the state is facing that seem to be intractable and figure out how to solve them. You know, usually they're economic issues, things that are impacting the state, either state finances or economic growth of the state, or just pocketbook issues for families that are struggling. And there's a lot of families out there that are struggling right now. And we'll get into a little bit here why, you know, what Campaign for Vermont is doing in that area to try to help folks as we're, you know, trying to come out of this pandemic.
That's great. It's a think tank, scary for people who know me, but that's what it is. We just put out an annual survey, which I found fascinating. Could you talk about it? And I understand that the responses are coming back fast and furious.
Yeah, you know, and we always do an annual survey of our membership to try to figure out what people really care about, what issues we should focus on in the legislative session. And so usually it comes out in January. And this year we opened it up, really tried to think about it a little differently, and we opened it up to everyone, not just people that are, you know, donors or members of the organization, but we made it open-ended so anyone could respond to the survey. And we also looked at things, you know, what were going to impact people's daily lives right now, because everyone's in a slightly different situation with the pandemic. And, you know, there's not a one-size-fits-all solution. You know, it's easy to say, let's go write, you know, $2,000 checks to every Vermonter and be done with it. But the problem is that, you know, some people are out of a job and need $2,000 a month, not just a one-time check.
Right.
There's other people that are, you know, still working full-time or maybe even working overtime because they're a healthcare provider or what have you, and they don't necessarily need that $2,000. So how do you get, you know, how do you get money to people who need it, who families who are struggling to put food on the table, and make sure that they're the ones that are benefiting from this? And that is, you know, one of the things that we try to look at when we put the survey together is figure out who those people are and what is it that's most useful to them. Is it a, you know, check? Is it, you know, child care assistance? Is it, you know, more unemployment benefits? What is it that's going to impact those people?
So you gave folks a list of a couple of items that you wanted to know whether we should focus on that or not. And could you go through that list for us and let us know what they had to say?
Yeah, you know, we, as I'm looking at it right now, we have 110 responses as of this morning. So that's quite a bit more than we usually have. It's kind of usually around the 30, 40 range. So definitely a lot of interest, and that was just putting it out on email and social media, like to folks that maybe follow Campaign for Vermont. So definitely, you know, pretty surprised in 3 days what the response has been, which is great. We asked questions. The first question we asked was around what we think the legislature should focus on in 2021, and that was kind of broad strokes. So things like, you know, should we focus on stopping the spread of the pandemic? Should we focus on vaccinating as many people as possible? Should we focus on rebuilding the economy? Maybe the focus should be, you know, don't forget about climate change or any of the other crises that the state is going through on top of the pandemic. And by and large, you know, respondents, almost half, said rebuilding after the pandemic, rebuilding the economy, small businesses were top of mind as to what the legislature should be focusing on. You know, almost a quarter of respondents said that vaccinating as many people as possible was second largest priority, and that was far and away above actually trying to stop the spread of the pandemic. So it's kind of more of a question of approach than anything else, which is interesting. And so that's, you know, one of the other things that's interesting there is that while the legislature is certainly focused right now on economic recovery and making sure that stimulus money goes where it needs to go, there really aren't any plans in the legislature around vaccination programs. Like, that's something the legislature really hasn't taken up, haven't spent much time on, if any time on at this point, and, you know, largely has been left up to the administration.
So when you get all this put together, are you going to presume a press release, but also maybe some emails to the legislators to let them know what people in our answering this response really want? Because you also included addressing the opioid crisis, and the COVID has sort of gone before the opioid crisis. But I can assure folks that it's still here. And it's still a crisis. And if anything, the COVID hasn't helped one bit, and it's probably making it a little worse.
Well, certainly it's not making it better, and there's a lot of evidence out there to suggest that, you know, when we talk about opiates and addiction in general, you know, they are it's a mental health issue.
Yep, right.
Largely, right? There's obviously physical components to that, but addiction is a mental health issue, and there's a lot of evidence to suggest that the pandemic is exacerbating mental health issues.
Yep.
So certainly, you know, certainly not making the situation any better. But you're right. What's interesting is that out of all of the crises that are going on, respondents were more interested in, you know, climate change and water quality than they were in opiates.
Interesting. Well, I think we've taken our attention away from it because of COVID. So, and you asked two questions, which I loved on the survey because it's so personal. You said, what causes you and your family the most anxiety? And then the second question was, Governor Scott talks a lot about affordability, and what does that mean? We're always talking about wanting Vermont to be more affordable. What does it mean? You must have gotten some great responses.
Yeah, you know, so let me tackle that second one first, because it's a little more straightforward. The, you know, what does affordability mean to you? This is a question that, you know, we've talked about a campaign for Vermont for a couple of years now. And what does affordability mean? The governor uses it a lot. He campaigned on it. But what does it mean? And maybe the definition varies from person to person. Maybe it means something different for me than it means for you, than the guy up the street. Maybe it's maybe we all have our own definition. And so we wanted to try to explore that a little bit. So we asked people, does that mean for you? Does that mean lower cost of living? Does that mean higher income? Does that mean better safety net programs, or does that mean a combination of the three? And interestingly enough, it's almost an even split between people who said it's a combination of the three, lower cost of living, better income, better safety net programs. And that was almost an even split with people who said just lower cost of living. So, you know, that's an interesting takeaway, you know, and then also, you know, you would think more people would say, oh, higher income, more money. But actually, very few people said that. Even fewer people said better safety net programs.
Interesting.
And I would lump child care subsidies and things like that into that group. So really, what people are addressing or defining as affordability, in most cases means either a combination of income and expenses or just expenses. The vast majority of what people mean when they use that term.
Very interesting. What did they say about anxiety? I don't know how that is certainly individual.
Right. Yeah. And it is very highly individual. And we actually left that question, you know, instead of being, a multi-choice question like the other questions that we asked, we actually left it as an open-ended question to allow people to respond, however they wanted to. They could enter up to, I think, 500 characters. They could give a little bit an explanation to how they were thinking about this. I can read you some of the responses, not with names attached, of course, but we'll keep it anonymous. But
yep.
Things like the slowness of vaccine shots, not being distributed as fast, although, you know, Vermont is certainly one of the faster ones in the country, but, how quickly we come out of this pandemic is largely tied to that. Things like political discord and political divisiveness, are things that are top of mind for a lot of people. That's not surprising after the events in Washington last month.
Right. Ben, we have a call that's come in. It's Vic from Middlesex, if we could get Vic on the line.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. I find it interesting that you guys are kind of excited about 105 people responding to a survey. It would be nice if you had 200,000 people and get a real good cross-section. But I realize
yeah, I really
you probably can't get that. You probably can't get that. But I also think that there's two other things I got. I also think it's very, very odd that nobody in this survey or I shouldn't say anything that you've told us so far, have nothing to say about property taxes, and yet the legislature has just come out with property tax to be paid by income instead of property tax, which is probably more fair than anything. And I also think it's very funny that our governor doesn't have any interest in listening to that, because we got to walk before we can run over COVID. Well, we've been listening about COVID and its campaign on that for quite a while. I'm not saying it's not important, but I think we can. I think we're at a point in our life where we can take up some of this. If you anybody that I ask, they're most upset about the amount of school tax that they're paying at this time. And just as a side note, I also think that you just had Sue Minter on there, and she was talking about all these programs that Capstone does for people. Now, I can't assume they're all young people or what, but I think it's also, I've heard several things in the recent past that our education, our national education, and our teachers and our schools are somewhat letting us down, because kids are getting out with no idea how to do some of these things that are basic for going through life.
All right.
And with that, I will stop.
Thanks for your input, Vic. Ben, you want to respond to any of that?
Yeah, well, you know, you hit an issue that's near and dear to my heart. I've spent my majority of my work in the policy development area has been in public education, and just specifically education finance. So that's a topic I know a lot about. I've worked very closely with. The income tax is an interesting idea. It's one that's been tossed around in Montpelier quite a bit the last several years. The House, which all spending bills have to come out of the House, they haven't figured out a way to implement it yet, which is kind of the problem. They're taking another serious look at it again this year. My only thought on that really is more of a word of caution, is that we already basically have an income tax system in Vermont. We have a program called Income Sensitivity. 2/3 of property taxpayers use income sensitivity to pay their property tax assessments, and that is based on income. And any income tax mechanism that we put in place is likely to is likely to be very similar to that. There's a bigger issue going on there. It's not just people's ability to pay, which, you can argue an income tax system may be more reflective of that. There's an overall spending problem as well. And there was some good news this past week. They downgraded the estimate for what property tax increases are going to look like this year. So there's some good news there. It's down quite significantly. It will look like it might have been a 9-cent increase on the statewide property tax value, and it looks like it's going to be more like a 1-cent increase with the new numbers that came out this week. So there is some good news there, but I would caution that, we basically have an income tax system now, and, moving to a full income tax system is really just rearranging the deck chairs.
Right. We agree. And we've been covering that, and we'll probably still continue to cover it through Campaign for Vermont. You said we had 110, and that was just over the weekend. This survey is available on Campaign for Vermont website. Ben, can you give us contact information so people can participate?
Yeah, it's campaignforvermont.org, and you'll see it right in the navigation bar. It'll be the 2021 legislative survey, so it's still open. People can still respond. I'm looking at responses coming in right now, so it's exciting. But, yeah, I mean, 100 is pretty good. That's getting close to being statistically significant.
Yeah.
Of course, I'd love it if we had 2,000.
Well, Rick's right. I sometimes us Vermonters are not as participatory as we should be. You've got to stand up and speak out. So this is one way to do it, which would be great, because we'll get it to the legislators and back out to you. You've heard it first right here at WDEV. Right, Ben? Hot off the press.
Absolutely.
That's great.
Yeah,
so is there anything else you want to talk about the survey? Because I wanted to talk about the two recent initiatives we've been involved in.
We can go. We can talk about that. The only thing I'd say on the survey is that we're going to use this both to help educate legislators, but also to educate us about what issues we should be focusing on.
Yep. We're all registered lobbyists. For those of you who know me, you're like, what? But anyway, we're part of the lobbying gang. So we put out an editorial, I think about 2 weeks ago, and it was called Smog Over Montpelier. Could you summarize that editorial for us? And we've gotten some feedback on that editorial for sure.
Yeah, you know, Eric LaMontagne is another one of the board members at CFE, and I wrote that op-ed. And really what it's about, it was in response to an op-ed that was written by Linda Joy Sullivan, who's a state representative from down in the Bennington area. And she had a really good point of coming into this legislative session around looking at real issues, like a lot of stuff we've been talking about, like what is impacting Vermonters. It's not the time to be trying to do huge reforms or get, you know, big complicated ideas through. We need to get back to basics. And that is something that really struck a note with us. Like this is a complicated year. There's a lot of moving pieces. There's federal dollars coming in. There's people that are struggling to put food on the table. We need to make sure that those basic needs are being met. So that's really what the op-ed was about, and talking about that and what we can do and what the legislature should be focused on.
It's good. And if you haven't seen it in any of the press, it is on the Campaign for Vermont website. The other thing that we were asked to participate in by Jeanette White, who's the chair of Senate Government Operations, was to weigh in on what we thought changes should be made to the election process here in Vermont. And they're putting a list together of all of the suggestions that they've received from around Vermont. And we weighed in last week. Ben, could you talk about that?
Yeah, and of course, Senator White is a familiar face. We worked with her very closely on the ethics legislation that we got passed a couple of years ago. So, and we've done, some work on elections law and elections reform in the past, things like same-day voter registration, things like that. So she asked us to weigh in on this issue. Really, this is in response to how the universal mail-in voting system worked this past year or this past election. And I think, we're very much in the same boat as the Secretary of State. You know, he's open to doing this, making this a regular feature of Vermont elections. We think we agree that it helps to increase access, ease of access to our election system. If we're going to make this a regular feature, there's other things that we should probably look at to make sure we have clean voter rolls. A lot of town clerks are reporting that, they had hundreds of ballots that came back as undeliverable. There's probably some additional resources needed for helping to process those ballots that come back. They take longer to process, obviously, than a ballot that's cast in person that you're putting into the voter tabulator yourself. So there's probably some things we need to think through there to make sure that town clerks have the tools they need to actually carry out these types of elections if we're going to shift more towards a mail-in voting system.
When I was testifying over Zoom to the committee, the heads were nodding when I talked about the checklist and how we should have more flexibility in taking names off. And because we have same-day registration, if we make a mistake, as a town makes a mistake, you can easily add the person back on. So, but those lists are just too – I think we've been a little too conservative on how we've handled those lists. Don't you agree?
Yeah, I would agree, and rightfully so. When, it took months to petition to get back on, the voter rolls, and you had to bring in evidence of utility bills and all kinds of stuff like that. A lengthy process to remove someone from the voter rolls when it took so long to get back on made a lot of sense. But that's not where we live today. Today you can walk in and register to vote and cast the ballot right there. Thanks to same-day voter registration. So I think, we have the opportunity to change our election system so that it's easier to keep those voter rolls up to date. Right. You don't have to be as conservative about removing people as we used to be, because the likelihood of accidentally blocking someone from casting a ballot is pretty low.
Ben, I want to thank you for being on the show this afternoon. I hope folks will check out Campaign for Vermont. We're going off to a hard break, and we'll be back. Thank you very much. Thanks, Ben.
Thanks, Pat.
Let's celebrate Valentine's Day at the Warren Store with a very special meal created by our culinary experts. Check out warrenstore.com for details. We have a great assortment of cards and gifts and chocolate-dipped strawberries. Upstairs, we have puzzles, journals, art supplies, and candles to warm and while away the winter days. Dress yourself in cozy tops, snuggly sweaters, and happy colors. You can now order online from the deli at warrenstore.com. Warren Village is a winter wonderland, so come to soothe your soul, fill your tummy, and dress your body. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, open 7:30 to 5.
Well, welcome back. This is Pat McDonald, your guest host for Vermont Viewpoint. Rick Sangari will be back tomorrow. If you want to call in to talk to my guest, the number here is 244-1777 on WDEV. My guest for this segment is Gary Freymeyer. Gary is the president of the submarine USS Vermont. It's the support group, which is an all-volunteer organization that began as part of the Vermont Commissioning Committee. Gary, are you on with us?
Yes, I am, and good morning, Pat.
Good morning. Nice to see you again, or hear your voice anyway. Can you tell us about the USS Vermont itself and about its crew, which I find fascinating?
Sure. The USS Vermont itself is our state's third naval vessel with that name. She's a Virginia-class nuclear sub, 377 feet long, 34 feet at the beam. And displaces about 7,835 tons of water. She's the 19th submarine in the Virginia class and was commissioned into active duty on April 18th. She's got a crew of about 140, 20 officers, and 120 enlisted. And at commissioning, we actually had two Vermonters on board, Ian Blackmore from Danville and Trevor Johnson from Rutland.
So, and tell me, they all have to volunteer for the submarine service. Is that correct?
Yeah, they do. And, you know, I can tell you a little bit about the subsailors, but since I'm not a Navy vet, I can only kind of give you my impressions of the officers and crew members I've met.
Okay.
And to a person, they're high-character men. They're enthusiastic, unflappable under pressure. You know, they're the kind of guys you trust with your life because you pretty much do. And they volunteer to be a submariner, and they undergo a substantial amount of screening. You can't even be a little claustrophobic, as you can imagine. And you have to be able to adjust your biorhythms to 18-hour days, six on duty, six training, six sleeping.
So I hadn't heard that. Is six training every day?
Yep. They have 18-hour days, which I found interesting.
Yeah.
But apparently that's pretty efficient in the way they do it. And interestingly, they not only need to be skilled in their own role on the boat, like mechanic, electric, weaponry, nuclear, culinary, whatever, but they also have to be knowledgeable about all the other roles as well to become a qualified submariner and get their dolphin pins.
I don't know if you have this information with you, but when we were talking on our show, you said how long that submarine can last underwater. And if it wasn't for food, it's a long stretch.
Well, effectively, the answer is indefinitely. The only two things that need to bring the boat up are food, as you mentioned,
yep.
And if there are some mechanical issues.
Wow.
But other than that, they could stay under indefinitely as they manufacture their own oxygen.
I think I'm having trouble with staying at home in COVID. I'm not sure I do well in the submarine service. But anyway, you've done a lot of work with your support group. And could you talk about some of the things that you've done and maybe announce something that's very exciting for us here in Vermont?
Well, yeah, I'll just to frame our activities, the USS Vermont Support Group, we call it the VSG, basically represents all Vermonters in supporting the USS Vermont, her crew, and families over the 30-plus year life of the boat. So we're pretty much the stewards of the relationship between the boat and her namesake state. And with the sub at sea, the VSG first reached out to the Vermont FRG, which is the Family Readiness Group, pretty much a mutual support group made up of the wives and families of the sailors. And, you know, we wanted to let them know that we were in place to bring a little relief to their challenges with gift cards with their spouses at sea for so long. So we partnered with Vermont Teddy Bear also for 24 Dewey Bears for the FRG to present to new crew babies and for prizes for children's contests during the quarantine. We also provided canvas gift bags with the boat's name on one side and Vermont's Freedom and Unity motto on the other for the FRG to give to sailors who are rotating into the USS Vermont crew. The FRG calls them sunshine bags, and they include several gifts in the boat to welcome new sailors to the boat. And as honorary Vermonters, they'll find in those bags maple syrup and Vermont Strong license plates, thanks to our partnerships with the Vermont Maple Syrup Makers Association and Vermont's DMV.
That's great. And they just announced that, the Vermont Maple Syrup, a week or so ago. Wasn't that correct? You heard from them that they're going to do this?
It's a wonderful partnership. There are 12 member counties in the VMFMA, and the first county that's going to provide syrup to the boat is Orange County. And at the board meeting where this was approved, the second county was Lamoille, and their lead, Arnie Piper, stepped up and said he wanted to do it next year.
Nice.
So as the years progress, each of the 12 counties will have a shot at being the syrup provider for the USS Vermont.
That's great. And the Vermont Strong plates are, I mean, they're just recognizable everywhere around this region.
Yeah, each plank owner, the first crew for the commissioned boat, got one of those, and we kind of decided it would be great to give all the incoming sailors, all the part of Vermont's family, their own license plate, Vermont Strong, just to make them, you know, help them know that they're part of a larger group up here.
That's great. You mentioned plank owners, and I can't go on without asking you to explain that, because that's pretty, that's very emotional, I would think.
Well, you know, it's probably a rare honor for the majority of the Navy folks out there to be the crew of a newly commissioned boat. But they'll get an individual plaque that's shaped like Vermont, and it's got a number of design elements on it that represent the state very well. And they'll get a certificate from the Navy honoring them as plank owners, the first crew on the USS Vermont.
That's great.
And what we also did was to kind of give them a little bit of enduring presence. There is a plaque now mounted permanently on the boat that has a list of all the plank owners,
awesome.
The first 138 crew members of the boat.
That's great. We also we did a show, Vote for Vermont, about a week ago, and joining us was Al Perry, who his whole family, he told us, has had service combined of 150 years of submarine service, which is just amazing to me. Al was a former representative whom I served with, and I was like a kid, because I was talking to Al Perry. It was like having my hero. He's a wonderful guy. So you've got some good people helping you, Gary, for sure. We've got a caller. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just saying, there's no question Al and his family, Al's a national treasure.
Yeah.
What he and his family have contributed to our safety is, it's amazing, and it will only endure with grandchildren heading to the academy, that sort of thing. So it's a phenomenal family, and we're proud to have them as part of us.
Absolutely, love them. So we have a caller, Fred from Newberry. If you can hang on, Gary, we'll see what Fred wants to ask us. Fred?
Oh, morning.
Morning.
Hey, it's very interesting. The cost of a Virginia-class submarine can range from, just for easy arithmetic, $2 billion to $3 billion. And an aircraft carrier can cost as much as $14 billion.
Hmm.
And then the aircraft carrier has about 4,000 people on it, so that kicks the cost up, plus very expensive war machines like airplanes, and that kicks the cost up. So basically, the most effective warship the Navy has today is the nuclear submarine, the Virginia-class nuclear submarine. And then there's one other interesting thing. Submarines, you can't see.
Mm-hmm.
Aircraft carriers, you can. And then, to kick it off, the torpedoes that they use are totally different than the torpedoes during World War II. These torpedoes can go for 20 miles. If they miss the first time, they can come back and try it again. And then thirdly, the torpedoes don't strike the ship. They detonate right underneath the ship. And that, what it does is it cracks the keel, and it makes a big steam bubble, and the ship falls into the steam bubble because the steam bubble won't support the ship.
I didn't know that. That's fascinating. Gary, you want to respond to Fred? Thank you for your input. That's an interesting concept. What do you think, Gary?
I think Fred pretty much is one of the, I'm guessing, he's one of the, what we were surprised to find was almost 120 submarine veterans here in the state of Vermont.
Is that true, Fred? Are you a vet?
I'm a vet, but not a submariner.
Well, thank you for your service, regardless of how you serve. That's awesome. So, Gary, he makes a good point.
Yeah, we don't even know what all the capabilities of the boat are, and it's not something that is discussed publicly.
Have to kill
you,
right?
Also, yeah, they also have, and he talked about advanced torpedoes, but they also have Virginia payload modules, so they're able to launch missiles from under the water as well.
Hmm.
And it's one of the most lethal boats and quiet boats that we've ever produced. So it's a solid part of the deterrence, and our presence presenting our force in different parts of the world that are kind of experiencing unrest. The knowledge that there might be a submarine out there keeps a lot of people from bad actions.
Interesting. Thank you very much, Fred. I hadn't thought about it from that angle. Gary, you're looking for people to know about the boat and perhaps to jump in and help a little bit. How are you getting out, particularly in the COVID pandemic here, how are you getting out talking to folks about the USS Vermont and the help you need?
Well, I think through exchanges like this one, Pat, with yep. Vermonters, just letting them know about the boat and its crew. And clearly, since COVID limits our ability to bring sailors from the Vermont up here to meet with Vermonters, we're planning to do a Zoom briefing in the near future to hear from the commanding officer, Charles Phillips, and the chief of the boat, James Brownson, about some of their most recent experiences. You know, we plan to record that briefing and add it to video we already have to put together a program for grade schools across the state to educate kids about
perfect.
The USS Vermont. And hopefully stimulate some STEM education interest and mm-hmm. maybe even generate a few future Navy submariners.
That's great. Remember, WCAX did a story about the USS Vermont, and I remember they were up where all the action happens, and they had cardboard covering everything because it's so highly technical and a secret of what makes the ship run and all of its capabilities. I thought that was fascinating.
Well, I'll tell you, building on that, my son works for a company called Knowles Atomic Power Labs. They create the nuclear generators that run these submarines. And the nuclear power plant sits towards the back of the boat. And I made a comment to the commanding officer one day that the one thing I most want to see on the boat is what my son works with.
Hmm.
And he just smiled because that would be the end of his career
if
he was ever to allow anybody other than a nuclear-trained sailor in that part of the boat. So, yeah, there are an awful lot of things on that we'll never see or know about. But interestingly, and one of the things that might just draw a few more youngsters to this kind of a career, not only the old-fashioned periscope is gone and replaced by something called a photonic mast, but the entire boat is kind of a fly-by-wire setup right now. So there's, instead of the old mechanical things that slide up and down, they have a number of Xbox controllers on the boat that operates a number of the functions. So that resonates with the youngsters, I think.
I bet. It's like sitting in your own living room, except how long did you say the boat was before? I wanted to remember that.
Well, I'm practicing up for the kids' discussion. I'm going to ask them how long a football field is. Does anybody know? And they'll say 100 yards, 300 feet. It's 377 feet long.
Good grief. And there's so many people here in Vermont who volunteer for the boat. And they had a great story about delivering maple syrup down to the president of Mexico. Let me see. Gary, are you back on?
Yep, I'm back on.
I've been blabbing away here. good thing I remembered what we talked about. But so where were we? I was asking you about how you're reaching out to associations and businesses who want to get on board to support the USS Vermont, because not only the sailors, but their families as well, because I'm sure they're gone for stretches of time. We asked on the show, where is the boat? And we were told can't tell you that. So it's out there somewhere.
Well, the we can't tell you that would suggest we know.
And we don't. We don't know, do we?
No. Yeah. We find out generally, even when the boat comes and goes, we don't find out about that until 24 hours after it's happened.
Oh, no kidding.
As you can imagine, one of the things that our adversaries would like to know is they'd like to know that boat that just left Groton, an hour ago, they'd like to do everything they could to see if they could listen to it, track it, that sort of thing.
Right. I was just trying.
It's usually at least 24 hours.
I was just trying to explain how we brought maple syrup to South America one day. Could you explain that story?
Well, just, yeah, quickly, I got a phone call from the CO when he was in a hospital parking lot as his wife was inside. They just had a baby. So he called and asked if there was any suggestions I might have for a gift to a, quote-unquote, foreign head of state. And I said, he said he wanted it to be a Vermont flavor. And I said, well, let's think about glass maple syrup leaves, and reached out to Burmore's. And Burmore's, he had several of them. So we were able to pick them up and get them down to the boat. Then we traveled about 5,000 miles down to Brazil, a port outside, a naval base just outside of Rio de Janeiro. And were presented to the president, President Bolsonaro of Brazil.
Great.
Along with a couple other dignitaries. So.
That's great.
It was a banner day for Vermont maple syrup.
Absolutely. Gary, when we lost you there for a moment, I was feebly trying to explain about what happened to the commissioning ceremony that was scheduled for April 18th in Groton. And maybe you can tell us and what happened there and then what's being planned for the future.
Well, the administrative commissioning did take place on schedule on April 18th, and it basically was a small group of sailors on the boat, the captain presenting the program for the commissioning. One of the things that they did was they raised the commissioning flag, and they blew the ship's whistle 19 times because the Vermont is the 19th boat in the Virginia class.
Cool.
They also played Anchors Away, traditional Navy song, and Sinatra's Moonlight in Vermont.
That would have gotten me in tears, Gary. Just good thing I wasn't there. That's great.
Yeah, it was. I'm sure it was delightful, but it was certainly nothing like any of us had expected. And for the go forward situation, right now I know that that the commissioning committee, along with the sponsor Gloria Valdez, Commander Phillips, they're all working with the Navy to determine specifics of an event that will occur this summer.
Right.
And we know that the original 2,500 people on a pier in Groton won't be possible between the Navy and Connecticut COVID restrictions, but it's still important to hold the scaled-down events that, you know, kind of ensure the boat, crew, and families, along with some of our partners and supporters, can still experience what we'd have to consider a once-in-a-lifetime event.
How do you get to participate? Are there tickets, or how do you get to go?
Well, that remains to be determined. We did a ticketing process last time, and that we had 1,100 Vermonters scheduled to be down there.
Great.
So we'll determine that going forward, but we'll notify via the website exactly what's going to happen.
Yeah, that reminds me. Could you give the website number in case anybody wants to check out the history of the USS Vermont and perhaps raise your hand to volunteer?
Yeah, we welcome all Vermonters to join us through contact information below on the website. It's ussvermont.org or on the USS Vermont Support Group page on Facebook. You can learn a little bit more about our missions, objectives, and support activities.
That's great. Now, have they marched here in Montpelier, Gary?
Yeah,
I think that the sailors have marched here maybe on 4th of July a couple of times.
Yep, on the 18th and 2018, 2019 they were up, and they also that's where they first went up to Burr Morris's place to learn about sugaring.
Oh, what fun for them!
We did have a good representation up there, the crew, and hopefully, if COVID and restrictions allowing, you know, it would be great to be able to do that again this coming year.
Yeah, because I remember them marching, and I thought, oh, this is kind of like the old-fashioned 4th of July celebrations where we had sailors and soldiers and stuff, and it was great to see them. They got a wonderful reception. Could you tell me about – I keep asking you because I love it. I have it up on my refrigerator. the logo for the USS Vermont, because you were instrumental in – designing that, were you not, your group?
Well, just we basically took the ship's crest and we modified it to a degree that satisfied the Navy for our use. But what we also did for the Vermont Support Group (VSG) is we took an image of one of the more recognizable mountains in Vermont, Campbell's Hump.
Yep.
And we've got the Vermont state seal on one side and the ship's crest on the other, and it kind of tells the story of bridging the gap between the state and the boat. And folks will probably notice when they see it that there's a body of water underneath Camel's Hump that doesn't exist. But we had to have some place to float the USS Vermont in the picture.
Well, we've got whale tails somewhere around on 89, so I guess we can have a submarine on the logo. That's great. Could you talk a little bit about the calendar, which was designed by one of the group's members as well?
Yeah, a guy by the name of Bill Mattoon, a submarine vet. We had a number of pictures that were taken of prior boats that had a Vermont flavor to it. And Bill had the idea of putting them into a calendar, and that turned out to be one of our best fundraisers. And even though the calendar was for 2020, there's still a lot of historical value, and it's a great memento. There's still a few of them out there.
That's
but,
great.
Yeah, it was quite a great project.
That's great. So if I were to volunteer for your group, what would the expectations be? What would you want me to get involved in?
Well, basically, if you sign up, just give us an email at ussvtvsg@gmail.com, and that's on both the website and the Facebook page. But let us know you'd like to be part of the team supporting the USS Vermont. You'll be required to bring enthusiasm for our mission and hopefully some new ideas for things we can do to let the crew and their families know that we Vermonters appreciate their service and the sacrifices they make to keep us safe.
Gary, when you mentioned the families, how long are some of their, I don't know what's the word, I guess just trips, well, how long are they gone from their families at any one time?
Well, a normal deployment can be as much as 6 months. Mm-hmm. Our boat has been on a mini deployment that was just around 2 months, but they'll be in and out quite a bit in the coming months, because one of the things our boat's doing right now is with its advanced technology, it's helping other boats that are retrofitted go out and certify that they can use the same types of technology. So the USS Vermont is helping the rest of the boats in the Groton area to be ready for whatever missions they're called on to perform.
Well, it's just I hadn't heard that 6 hours of training every day. These guys are top-notch, I'm assuming. They just any emergency, and they're ready.
Indeed, and the amazing thing to me is not only do they have to know their job, but they have to know a lot about every other job that needs to be done in the boat.
Yeah, because I guess, and God forbid, something happened, and they've lost some of the folks with other technology information. They'd have to jump in and do their job.
Absolutely.
Wow, that's great. Well, thank you, Gary, very much for your work on this USS Vermont, and I hope folks will check out the website and the Facebook page and support our sailors. Thank you, Gary. Thanks for joining me. We're going to take a break.
The opportunity, Pat.
Thanks. Pat McDonald for WDEV.
Let's celebrate Valentine's Day at the Warren Store with a very special meal created by our culinary experts. Check out warrenstore.com for details. We have a great assortment of cards and gifts and chocolate-dipped strawberries. Upstairs, we have puzzles, journals, art supplies, and candles to warm and while away the winter days. Dress yourself in cozy tops, snuggly sweaters, and happy colors. You can now order online from the deli at warrenstore.com. Warren Village is a winter wonderland, so come to soothe your soul, fill your tummy, and dress your body. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, open 7:30 to 5.
Hi, this is your host, Pat McDonald, for Vermont Viewpoint. Welcoming our last guest this morning, last but not least, one of my favorite people in Vermont, Mary Moulton, who's the CEO for Washington County Mental Health Services. Mary, are you on with us?
I am. Can you hear me, Pat?
Yes, I can. Thank you very much.
So good to hear you this morning. Thank you for your kind words.
Well, listen, you know you're my hero. So Mary was acting commissioner for a while, and we missed her so much in Washington County. And fortunately, although she was doing a great job in Waterbury, we love to have her back home. Mary, I read an article from WebMD. Why I read that, I have no idea. But it was entitled, Mental Health, an Emerging Crisis of COVID Pandemic. So what have you seen in Vermont with the impact of COVID on emotional distress and folks starting to feel the psychological fallout of COVID? Staying home is not easy, Mary, for those of us who like to talk. I'm just saying.
I agree. It's, and for those of us who like to hug, it's even harder, right?
Oh, I know.
So absolutely, Pat. We have been talking a lot about this since the beginning of the pandemic, and that's because we had all the warning signs in front of us, and we knew that there was going to be a great deal of stress as a result of being asked, in fact, to isolate. You know, I often say if you want to take a vacation and you want to have that quiet space somewhere and you're going to go and have a solitary weekend, it's great, right? But when we're told we must, it actually plays very differently on our mind. And we have been told we must comply with rules of safety and isolation for almost a year now. So indeed, we are seeing and have been seeing levels of stress. I think what this brings out for us, actually, is working in a mental health agency here at Washington County, where we often talk about stigma and how we, you know, really want people to recognize that mental health is health, is that if there was anything that would highlight that for us, it's the pandemic. It affects our entire population. Mm-hmm. And so we are seeing stress, certainly due to school closures in children and in families. We see stress in ourselves, in not being able to move about, go to places, get out like we used to. Gathering is a big piece for many of us. And so these are things that we have not been able to do. We are seeing more people come in our doors. There's no doubt about that. We are seeing actually in the last probably couple of months quite a significant level of folks feeling anxiety and depression. Perhaps they haven't felt that before, but the good news is they're reaching out. We are seeing more people in emergency situations and coming in for therapy, so much so that, you know, we're having to shift folks because we can't get them in for ongoing therapy right off to groups, to other supports, to our urgent care division. We're doing the best we can, but it is extremely, extremely on the increase.
You know, you said something early on that absolutely stuck in my head, and it's so true. If we do something because we want to, is very different than being told to do that same thing. And that really hit home with me. That's so true. When you're told you must do this, you're like, well, no.
Right.
It's hard.
It's right, because it feels more like we're trapped, right?
Than that we're free.
And so what we need to do is to take every opportunity to take care of ourselves and be doing things that we are able to do. And so, you know, getting out, doing exercise, you know, going along with the governor's orders if we're able to, you know, with our masks, with our social distancing, be in our workplaces. We can do those things. I come into work quite often to my office and, in fact, almost every day. And, of course, at Washington County Mental Health, we have been open since we are a health care facility. So we run residential-type settings to support people, and we've been open since the pandemic and have always seen people with some restrictions at different times when we've really had a surge and we had to pull back. But we're, you know, I find that coming in is helpful to my mental health. I can say hi to someone across the hallway.
Right.
You know? I can chat. I can, you know, talk about the news. It really helps. And using our electronic devices to the extent that help us to communicate with each other is also extremely helpful.
Yeah, I was going to ask if there, because of COVID, your people, there must be restrictions going out to people's homes because people, I would think, in crises really need to have a presence there to diffuse the situation, and that's hard to do over Zoom or whatever we're using, isn't it?
It is. It's extremely hard. And so we go out when we need to. But we are careful, and so it's changed. You know, when our numbers are, when we have surges, we're much more careful. You know, we're a community outreach agency, so we're used to putting people in our cars and, mm-hmm. you know, taking them to their doctor's appointments. And all that had to stop in the beginning. Mm-hmm. We were very able, and I'm so glad that we have the electronic system that we have, because we were able to pivot really quickly to telemedicine, mm-hmm. to
right.
telehealth. And, you know, we literally went from using none of that to, you know, at this point, millions of minutes on our telehealth system. So we do that with therapy, although there are some people who absolutely need to be seen, because it is much too hard for them to interact over Zoom, for example.
Oh, sure.
So we go out and we do see folks in emergency services. You know, we're going into the emergency rooms, although we Zoomed there for a while, too, because the hospital had very strict safety precautions. That's been a challenge. You just, when you're able to be face-to-face with someone, it makes a difference.
Yeah, right.
However, the positives were that there are some people who had trouble with transportation getting to us sometimes. So they were able to take advantage of Zoom, and, you know, hopping on a call with their therapist, for example,
mm-hmm.
made a really big difference.
You know what I found with telemarketing? I love my doctor. I had to change doctors recently because mine retired. And we did a telemedicine a meeting.
Yep.
And it felt very much that he was paying total attention to me, because we were looking at the screen at each other. And I found it different than maybe being in the office with people coming in and out, or the computers there, even though I love my doctor. But it was a different feeling face-to-face talking about what the issues are.
Absolutely. It's a skill set. And we're all still learning that. And so what I want to stress is that we can get better at
mm-hmm.
that. You know, for teachers,
yep.
having to be Zooming with their students all the time has been so hard. And delivering lessons that way for students, for our kiddos,
yep.
to, you know, have be on the receiving end of that sitting, it's good for some. It's hard for others. We're all different learners. So, you know, we are now, you know, seeing all the trainings on how to do this better, and we're working
on
it.
Right.
Yeah.
That's, I just think after COVID, we're going to see a big change in a lot of things.
Yeah.
And this is going to be one of them, the telemedicine concept. I know CBHHH uses the electronics to measure your heart rate and your blood pressure, and gongs go off when things aren't where they're supposed to be. So we're going to see a new world when this
Absolutely.
Is over.
Absolutely. And we want to maintain those good best practices that
right.
we learned.
Just get me out of the house, man. That's all I'm saying.
Absolutely.
So how is the dynamics on children and families? Because it's just at home, it's just myself, my husband, and my dog. But if we had kids who... I mean, you must see a lot of children these days, I would think.
We sure do. And I think families have been balancing so many things. You know, they were, before the pandemic, they were balancing running their kids up and down the road to different events.
Right.
And now it's, okay, I'm working remotely. My kids are in school today, and they're at home, and so do I. How do I work at home, and how do I have my kids on their school schedule
mm-hmm.
time?
Mm-hmm.
This is all an additional level of stress for families. So I see it in my own staff who are balancing their workloads, some of them absolutely coming into work. We have staff who are working in our schools. Again, we're so grateful mm. to our schools, actually, that they can be open here in Vermont, taking a day off or 2 days off a week for cleaning. But, you know, overall, I think we've had incredibly good sensibilities and extremely good safety precautions, so that our overall outcome in schools has been good. Mm. However, just for families and balancing the work, the way the work changed, it's been difficult. Kids, when they go to school, having to, you know, employ the same safety precautions, see masks, wear masks,
mm-hmm.
they seem to be more natural with them. You know, I see my own grandchildren, and, you know, they were out playing soccer in the fall, and they had their masks on, and it felt natural to them. But, you know, the things like when you're having to be home, you know, touching is a big
right.
factor
yep.
for us. Being able to run up and hug
mm-hmm.
as kids is a big factor. This has played a role, and the changing schedules where you're in school one day and then perhaps there's a COVID positive case.
Right.
And so school is out. Kids have been on a bit of a roller coaster ride. So that has been played into anxiety levels for them. You know, I think we're all at a place where we would really like to see this over, right? I mean, we're done. It's like, okay, can we get back to some normal? And
right.
our normal has changed. Kids have felt that. And so we are seeing levels of anxiety in children and receiving calls saying, how do I help my child with anxiety?
What are some of the things you tell folks about how to deal with that? Are there things that you recommend that maybe would ease the anxiety?
Well, certainly talking about it openly
mm-hmm.
with your child is important, that this isn't something that's going to last forever, that this is something we have to attend to right now to be safe for everybody, and setting a routine where you can, where there
right.
is a regularity
yep.
and a pace,
yep.
making sure that children also have some outside time, some excitement time, you know, setting up a special event activity in the house, you know, these and being able for them, if school is out, to communicate with friends, to actually have time with friends.
Right.
And that is, even if it's over Zoom,
yep.
You know, taking a part as a parent and reading a story to a couple of kids and talking mm-hmm. about it. All these things really help developing something that brings normalcy.
That's great.
Lives.
I think structure is sort of the key word, isn't it, Mary? They just want to know what's happening, and whatever that structure is, that's good for the kids.
Absolutely. And you know, I mean, again, there is a balance. So with that structure, with some flexibility
yep.
for
yep.
parents. And then we need support for parents. So talking to each other about how, you know, let's not pretend this isn't hard. It sure is.
Yeah, and I was going to talk a little bit before the end of the show about the caregivers, because
yeah.
I'm sure in your world you deal a lot with caregivers who
Absolutely.
Need a break too.
Oh, such a shout out. I just want to give a shout out to our caregivers, our shared living providers, we call them. You know, we have people with developmental and intellectual disabilities living in over 100 homes in our county. And they have taken on, you know, having to be home, because when we were very mobile, we did pull that back in the beginning, a little better now,
mm-hmm.
of course, but they took on a huge responsibility, and they have done an excellent job in giving supports. We would be delivering what we would normally do face-to-face, like activities to people's doors. We still do that. We send out a daily electronic newsletter with ideas for activities.
Great.
But imagine, for example, being a person who cannot communicate, who can't
mm-hmm.
verbalize, and your person who helps you to communicate every day through typing assistance, perhaps, they can't be by your side because of the COVID restrictions. And so that really isolated a lot of our folks who have developmental intellectual disabilities and autism. And so with that came tremendous stress for them.
Right.
And we are seeing more mental health crisis with people who are feeling the repercussions of that. So
well, I'm sure
that's
it's something,
another increase.
Yeah, they don't understand. I mean, it's something that's hard to explain for us.
Yes.
And
yeah.
if you're dealing with a developmental intellectual disability, I mean, how do you grasp what's happening and that it is going to end at some point?
It is.
But
we're going to be relieved.
Yeah, yes, we are.
We are very fortunate to have, you know, many vaccines to that population.
Excellent.
So, you know, we are on that road. And I just, again, Vermont Department of Health, within our residential facilities and for our shared living providers, have done an excellent job at getting the vaccine to us.
That's great. If a caregiver needs to take a break, are there people that will come in and give them a half a day off or a day off?
Yeah.
Or...
Yes, they have, all of our caregivers have respite providers if or respite situations. That became harder also, though, during COVID because of restrictions. So they've just they have done a phenomenal job, as have families who manage themselves and had to be in that position where they were more home than having our support. So they've also stepped up so much, and we owe them a debt of gratitude.
That's great. Well, hopefully with this vaccine, with the both vaccines, that eventually things will lighten up and we can go out. I wanted to shift a little bit to the homeless, because I know that's a big part of your population and finding housing. And I was talking with Sue Minter about the word safe, that these folks just want to feel safe, find a place that's safe for them, because some places are not. And it must be a real burden these days because of finding housing.
It is. We have more people homeless than we have housing right now in Washington County. And I know Sue was on earlier. I don't know if she shared our most recent numbers looking in January at closing in on 400 people.
No, she didn't. So whatever.
And we're very fortunate that we were able to get people in. So we have a much clearer view of how many people are homeless. And we, as regional providers, meaning Capstone, ourselves, the Good Samaritan Haven, the Family Center, Downstreet Community Housing, all this large group has come together with as a task force to look at how do we help to solve this problem. So, we have a number of families who are homeless. We have individuals who are homeless, and they receive vouchers to stay in the hotels.
So you have family with children, with kids?
Families with children.
Really? Yeah. That's disturbing.
Yeah, 90 children right now in hotel situations.
I mean, Mayor, it was like 10 below zero, if not 20 below the other day. I mean, how do they?
The good news is they have a hotel voucher, so they are in. The part about, having a home, though, and having them be in a place that is safe, that is that they identify as theirs with family, is so important, and it's important for every individual who might not have a home right now. So we have a lot of work to do on that. As a group of providers in Washington County, we really are working hard and coming together on that problem.
And I know you've been working with Sue and others about getting food out to these folks so that they're, because I think you were the one that told me it was one in three Vermonters are deal with food insufficiency, which in an agricultural state I find slightly mind-boggling.
Food insecurity. And Sue has been front line and center on that.
Yep.
And hats off. We've done that within our own agency for our clients and our families during the pandemic and set up as a food site. And it made a big difference because even during the early stages of COVID, we were able to get to the door, bring food, and talk for a little bit, even if we were out on the sidewalk. So able to give support while bringing food was a good way to connect.
That's just kudos to you and your staff, probably 24/7, I'm sure.
It is 24/7.
Yeah, I can't imagine, because I know you care for your clients, and I'm sure you're doing everything you can. You've got an amazing staff. So you relayed to me a message that you would like our listeners to take to heart, if you could share that with them.
Well, yes. I mean, I said earlier that, mental health is health, and this is really a wake-up call to take care of ourselves and recognize that we all can be deeply affected by stress, and we need to tend to that. And we do have a statewide number. Actually, it's 211. If people are feeling the need for support, please do not hesitate. We don't want situations and the way our emotions are feeling to worsen. And so, if talking to friends and family don't help, 211, we have a COVID support line, and it was put together by Vermont Care Partners, which is all of our agencies together supporting this through FEMA dollars. And 211, ask for COVID support. We have excellent people on the line to just answer, hear what the problem is, and give you tips. And that's available throughout the day. And then our phone line for emergency, if it does become a situation that becomes worse, is a 24/7 line at 802-229-0591. And we are here if people feel the need, that they need greater help.
Mary Moulton, thank you very much for being on the show. It was great information. This is Pat McDonald signing off for Vermont Viewpoint. It's been a pleasure being your host. And Rick Sangari will be back tomorrow on WDEV.